Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our week-long workforce series wraps up with a look at how what we wear to our jobs has changed, as has the way we try to market ourselves to prospective employers. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
My name is Ruben Gallego. I'm a husband, a Marine, a father, and a proud Arizonan. And with the results we saw tonight, your next senator from the great state of Arizona.
As for me, well, I can say for certain that truth will never stop mattering to me. You will never stop mattering to me.
We have been analyzing Project 2025 for months now. I am reorganizing some things inside this office to be ready for this. Including and especially my Solicitor General's office. So we're taking it very, very seriously.
We are stronger than ever before right now. The last election cycle has shown it, where the Democrats have spent tens of millions of dollars to try to flip the chambers, but they've done so unsuccessfully.
We literally mirrored federal law. So the difference is Biden was not enforcing the law. Trump is going to enforce the law.
As governor, I have and will continue to stand up against actions that hurt our communities, but I will work with anyone who is doing what's right for Arizona.
And joining me to talk about the resolution of some outstanding races, the election of new leadership at the state capitol, and more are Daniel Scarpinato of Winged Victory Agency. Good morning, Daniel.
Good morning.
And Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategy. Stacey, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Stacey, let's start with the U.S. Senate race. Ruben Gallego, as we heard, declared victory. Carrie Lake kind of conceded, I guess. She sent out a video that kind of acknowledged that she was going to move on to something else. This seems like it was kind of, if not the, then the biggest bright spot for Democrats this election cycle.
Oh, for sure. It was a very big bright spot. And I would say that concession speech sounded more like you told AI to write a concession speech. I mean, it was the strangest assembly of words a candidate could put together. And so I think Carrie Lake, her defeat underscores how much the Arizona electorate doesn't want to see her representing us.
Yeah. So, Daniel, in that video, she talked a little bit about what is next for her. We heard that. But she didn't really say what is next for her. Is this the end of the electoral road for her, do you think, in Arizona?
Possibly. You know, I think that I was one who felt that this cycle she had a better campaign and a more disciplined message than the race in 22 for governor. And, you know, at the end of the day, she actually stepped backward in terms of the final result here in a year that, you know, has ended up to be a Republican wave year.
Yeah.
So there were a number of factors on that. Clearly, the weight of message. I mean, Ruben Gallego was up on television starting, I think, in April with a very positive message about himself. And she had some headwinds and challenges, including, you know, lack of support from the national level or people coming in late. So, you know, yes, look, running for office is difficult. She's been doing this now for 3.5 years. So I imagine there'll be some self-reflection of, you know, what now. But there's a lot of opportunities, I believe, for Republicans in this state in 2026. And I think people are going to be looking at, you know, some fresh faces out there.
So is it, would you expect her to maybe try to run for governor again? Or do you think maybe not?
You know, I don't know. That's up to her. But I thought that, you know, I know that some folks said, oh, she didn't concede or whatever. I mean, I thought the tone of the video was a much more conciliatory and positive tone. And I got the sense that, you know, maybe she's going to be looking at things other than running for office was my takeaway.
All right. So, Stacey, we saw over the last, you know, week and a half or so, the Gallego was consistently on top, but the margins were sort of fluctuating. He was up by a lot. He was, you know, Lake sort of cut into that. She cut into it more. He was up by a lot. I'm wondering if at the end of the day, and we still don't have all the votes, you know, we don't have all the details yet, but do you think the result of this race says more about Ruben Gallego or Kari Lake?
So it says quite a bit about both, which I know is kind of a dance around answer. But the truth is there are 100,000 fewer registered Democrats today than there were 4 years ago. So the fact that Ruben won by the margin that he did, or that it looks like he's going to, which is just under 100,000 votes, is extraordinary. It means Republicans, independents broke for him over her. And that says a lot about the discipline of his campaign and his fundraising prowess and the fact that he was able to define himself as a Marine, and that her stunts with the election denialism and that Capone's vault stunt where they were trying to unseal a divorce record that had absolutely nothing juicy in it didn't work. And the electorate saw through that. I think in large part, folks want to get back to the basics. And Rubin's ability to tack to the center certainly carried the state.
Well, so, you know, you mentioned that how Gallego won a number of Republicans and independents. And for so long, we've been talking about this for Democrats as the Kyrsten Sinema playbook, the Mark Kelly playbook, to some extent, the Katie Holmes playbook. Do you think that Gallego really used that, or did he maybe adjust it somewhat? Because he was coming from a far more left-leaning perspective than any of the other three, at least most recently.
Well, you look at some of the endorsements that he received, so that really underscore that he did exactly that, that he tacked to the center, used that playbook. He got an Arizona Police Association endorsement. In years previous, there would have been Democrats that didn't accept that endorsement. That obviously has evolved. And so endorsements like that matter when the margins are going to be as close as we knew they were going to be.
So, Daniel, given that, and given, as Stacey said, the Republicans' registration advantage in Arizona going up, is this, and I love asking people to wade into the internal politics of the other side, is this sort of, does this sort of playbook, will this, do you think, continue to work, or maybe be the way that Democrats have to run in Arizona, at least statewide or maybe countywide, in order to get elected?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it has been the playbook. I think, you know, they've run as an independent voice. It's all the same playbook. Now, I think what will be fascinating is Ruben Gallego as a U.S. senator, because he is much more, at least recently, progressive than Kyrsten Sinema was, than Mark Kelly. I think that's who he is in his heart. And he is now following two one-term U.S. senators who basically got railroaded by the politics of their party and of the moment.
Jeff Flake and Kyrsten Sinema.
Correct. And so, you know, he is succeeding them. And I think it will be interesting to see, is he more like a Kyrsten Sinema? Is he more like a Ruben Gallego? And how can he navigate the politics of these next 6 years? And what does that look like? I think that he, in many ways, was a very good candidate for the Democrats. He appealed across party lines. He raised a lot of money. There also were some cracks. I thought in the debate, you know, he didn't perform off the charts. I also think if he's wise, he will make himself available these next 6 years. I mean, I thought I'm a fan of Kyrsten Sinema in many ways, but I was always struck by the fact that both her and Jeff Flake didn't really do any Arizona media, didn't make the rounds, didn't do town halls. And I think that that's kind of what the public expects now, is a level of accessibility. Why are you voting this way, et cetera, et cetera.
Do you think that with Gallego and the Democrats in the Senate in the minority, does that perhaps change the way he votes, change the way he acts, than it would have been if Democrats had stayed in the majority?
It certainly does. And it certainly, not only the Democrats being in the minority in the Senate, but in the House having no control over the Supreme Court, having lost the White House, it's going to have to be very deliberative. And Ruben has shown the ability to do that. I mean, he was allowed to be as progressive as he wants to be in a district that was as safe as the one that he came from in the House, mm-hmm. that is now being represented by the woman they painted as MAGA in a primary. And so this, I think the evolution of the Latino vote in Arizona, I think the loss of Democrats just in net registration, the growth of the Republican Party, the growth of the number of independents, I think is going to put him in a position where if he wants to not go down in the same fate that his two predecessors have, he's going to continue to represent the plurality of Arizona, not just the progressive.
And let's not forget, which is why I think this will be so interesting to see what kind of U.S. senator. The reason Kyrsten Sinema won't be a U.S. senator is because of him. He pushed her out and he came in, and the whole debate about the filibuster was really what allowed him to catapult and block her out. And so how does he navigate this? And how progressive will he be? How much will he be pushing back against some of those institutional guards that she was such a fan of?
Let me ask you before we go to break, Daniel. We got some resolution on two congressional races that were considered competitive, that were close for a while. David Schweikert and Wences Kamani both reelected. Were you surprised by either of these or the ultimate margins, which in the end don't seem as close as maybe some people thought they could be?
I really wasn't. I mean, I was very involved in Juan Siskamani's race. I live in David Schweikert's mm-hmm. district. Juan's margin, which is at this point around 3 points, I think that's where it'll land, was exactly how we tracked things the last several weeks on that campaign. And I think that in those races in particular, because there were some congressional races that Democrats were able to flip across the country, I think it was a candidate quality issue in both of those races. And also, there was so much advertising in Arizona. So the Democrats outraised and outspent Republicans pretty much across the board. But there was so much clutter. And I often wondered those last few weeks, is anyone seeing this stuff? Is anyone hearing it? And I think the answer was they really weren't. It just became noise in Arizona because it was so overwhelming.
Stacey, what did you make of those?
Well, I also live in Schweikert's district, and I thought that the attack ads against Amish were wildly effective. I mean, he had recent votes on public safety issues that didn't align with a district that is freaked out about homelessness and crime writ large. Everybody's got a Ring camera. Phones are buzzing all the time because, you know, random man's walking down the street and my neighbors are freaking out. So I thought that was really effective. I didn't see the same level of attack against Schweikert, against the incumbent. And not only did he have a number of bad votes when he was a state legislator, but he's taken some weird positions at the federal level as well. And that just didn't cut through, to Daniel's point. And maybe it was fundraising, maybe it was strategy, maybe it was, you know, I was just in the wrong house that wasn't being targeted. But there was something missing, I think, in the level of communication with voters in the district after the primary, because Amish ran a really fantastic primary.
And a crowded primary,
very
too.
Very crowded.
All right, that is Stacey Pearson. I'm also joined by Daniel Scarpinato. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Friday NewsCap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday NewsCap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Stacey Pearson of Lumen Strategies and Daniel Scarpinato of Winged Victory Agency. Stacey, the Democrats and Governor Hobbs spent a lot of money, a lot of time to try to win control of one or both legislative chambers. In the end, the Democrats lost seats. At this moment, it's going to be 17-13 in the Senate for Republicans, 33-27 in the House, if my math is correct. What happened?
Well, to paraphrase what Senator Sinema said a few months ago, voters aren't buying what she's selling, what we're selling at the moment. And it was part of a national wave. I mean, look at Gretchen Whitmer lost control of both the House and the Senate in Michigan. Mm-hmm. So lots of strange or lots of change happened in state houses across the country. So I don't think there's any sum of money that the governor could have spent that would have solved this problem. And this is a situation familiar to both the governor from her time as a legislator and her chief of staff, Chad Campbell, who was the House minority leader with similar margins. they're in a position that is familiar to them, that they're going to be able to operate in successfully. And I think we're going to have an interesting couple of years.
So, Daniel, these margins are somewhat similar to what you and Governor Ducey worked with when he was in office and you were working for him. Does it change? Like, does having one or two extra seats in a chamber, does that really change the calculus at all?
Changes it big time. When you have one seat majorities, everyone is in charge. Everyone is the deciding
vote. Power players.
And also, by expanding these majorities on the Republican side, it means that you have more folks who are inclined to be common sense, who ran on working with both parties, who are interested in issues like transportation and water and education and things that are not on their face partisan. So that's a good thing. I think that the challenge is that what Stacey's saying is accurate, which is it might be that the governor could have spent twice as much or three times as much and it wouldn't have changed the outcome. But she did put a lot of time and money into this, and there is some bad blood because she went really aggressive after some of the people who I think would be most inclined to work and see eye to eye with the ninth floor. And so what my message to them would be is take the time. You know, Chad knows some of these people personally. Take the time. Go have drinks with them. Go have lunch with them. And show some humility and find those issues that you can see eye to eye on and kind of accept that there's some you can't. But I think they're going to have to do some diplomacy because there is some bad blood and hurt feelings for members who had, in some cases, $1 million spent against them with pretty aggressive advertising.
Is that something that, I mean, is that something that is on the minds of the ninth floor, do you think, trying to mend fences? I know when Chad Campbell, who you used to work with,
right,
went to take that job, there's a lot of discussion among Republicans in the legislature. Okay, look, we have somebody who's done this job. We know somebody that we know, somebody we can work with and communicate with. Do you get the sense this is something that the ninth floor is thinking about, mending fences and trying to maybe work toward getting some stuff done together?
So what I can say is that the governor spent a considerable amount of time calling all of the victors in the election last week, so Republicans, Democrats, County Board of Supervisors, top to bottom. I was surprised to see how well that was received. I mean, there were a number of tweets from folks that didn't expect to get a call from her, a congratulatory call. So certainly that's the approach is, look, we're all back on the same team. Of course, the governor of Arizona was going to try to flip a chamber in her image. And elections are always remarkably unpleasant. So I think, yes, there will be bridge building. And for the good of Arizona, we need this all to work.
Daniel, the legislators who were elected their leadership this week. In the Senate, things will stay more or less the same at the top with President Warren Peterson. In the House, Steve Montenegro, who's in his second stint in the legislature, will be taking over as Speaker. The former Speaker, Ben Thoma, of course, left to run for Congress this year. Does that make any difference, having someone like Steve Montenegro running the House as opposed to anyone else?
I think really well of Steve. I worked for him actually when he was Speaker Pro Tem in two previous lives ago. and he is someone who I think will bring some real seriousness to this job. I think him and Warren Peterson will make a great team. I do think there's a lot of issues to see eye to eye on. And I also think that he will be a great communicator to folks about the Republican agenda, particularly the Hispanic community. I haven't seen this reported, but I believe he might be the first Hispanic Speaker of the House. And I think that's a big deal. So I think there's a lot of real positive things that have come out of this, and it's a fresh start, even though he's been around for a while, two different stints at the Capitol.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of a fresh face and a fresh start for the House Republican caucus.
So we talked about the difference of having maybe a one-seat majority versus a two- or more-seat majority. In terms of a first-time speaker, he's been in leadership, as you referenced, mm-hmm. but for a first-time speaker, how helpful might it be that it's not, for him, a one-seat majority where everybody is the deciding vote?
I think it's hugely helpful. Also, what is unique about him is that he is, you rarely have a speaker who becomes speaker so early in their tenure. So he has 6 years now that he could serve as speaker. And that's a big deal. You haven't seen that in a very long time. And so I think that both in terms of the experience he brings, the ability for him to not be in this kind of, I've got 2 years, you know, Ben Thoma was immediately a lame duck when he became Speaker of the House, as were several of his predecessors. So I think there's a lot of positives from this.
Stacey, I'm curious what you make of the leadership that the Democrats elected in the House, Oscar De Los Santos, and the Senate, Priya Sundarajan, two people who had been in leadership positions, but not sort of at the top.
So I think there are a number of reasons those folks make sense. One being that they do represent a more progressive wing of the caucus. And to get those folks on board with a number of the governor's policy priorities is going to be extraordinarily important. And then geographically, we've got Southern Arizona representation, Maricopa County representation. It's important that we're not facing the same issues across the state in from north to south. So it's helpful to have folks there.
I'm curious, though, and we saw the Arizona Freedom Caucus this week send out a press release basically calling both of them communists. And, you know, so, you know, take that for what it's worth. But like, does that affect the Democrats' ability to either work with Republicans or like sort of get their message out when, you know, already before they're even sworn into their terms, you know, they have people on their side calling them communists?
It's cuckoo. That's cuckoo. But when you look at this in terms of who's covering what flank, the governor and Chad Campbell can certainly cover the moderates. And to have those leaders cover the left flank is extraordinarily important.
Well, two comments on this. One is we talked about, okay, Republicans have a little bit larger majority, what that means in terms of some breathing room. So the flip side is that now there are no moderates in the Democratic caucus because they lost all the swing seats. And so the caucus will be much more progressive. I think you saw that in these leadership races. I mean, in terms of looking for people who are going to bring decorum to the body, I'm not sure that this was the choice given, particularly in the House. I think that, again, thinking through how does the governor navigate this, she was elected with 13% of Republicans voting for her. I think for her to succeed in 2 years, she has to extend an olive branch. She has to demonstrate that she is working with Republicans on some things because, as Stacey has rightly pointed out, it's math. There aren't enough Democrats to win statewide without winning
right.
Republican swing yeah. voters. So that is going to be a very important element for her success and, frankly, for Adrian Fontes and Chris Mayes in 2026.
So I have about 25 seconds for each of you. I want to just end quickly. Do you think that the legislature and the governor will be able to get stuff done, given the margins and given the people involved in this?
Oh, I absolutely do.
What do you think, David?
They have no choice. They have to pass a budget. They have to finish. This isn't Washington, D.C. We have actual responsibilities here.
All right. We'll leave it there. Daniel Scarpinato, Stacey Pearson, thanks you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, Spaghetti Cumbia has been drawing large crowds from coast to coast for nearly a decade. Now, for the first time, the band is bringing its genre-bending cumbia to Phoenix. But first, for the first time ever, our workforce is made up of six different generations of workers, from boomers to zoomers. The average lifespan is going up, and so is the cost of living, which means more workers are delaying retirement, just as Generation Alpha gears up to start their first jobs. This has presented some interesting challenges when it comes to intergenerational collaboration and interpersonal relationships in the workplace. And today, in our week-long spotlight on the workforce, we're going to talk about a big one, clothes, and what we wear when we go to work.
This is at times something that I derive a lot of meaning and passion from. And at other times, this is the thing that supports me and pays for my material existence.
Why should I buy a whole second wardrobe to wear to an office building? tipping as a social practice is one that is inherently rooted in social difference and also, in many ways, class hierarchy.
We see this growth of people turning to gig work because they're not making enough money at their job or because the cost of living has simply gone up and their paycheck hasn't kept up.
It used to be that men wear full suits at the office and women wore nylons and heels, but we're a long way from Mad Men today. Especially post-pandemic, workwear has become increasingly casual, spearheaded by Gen Z and their take on what to wear to the office. My co-host Lauren Gilger spoke more about it with Danielle Testa, associate professor at ASU FITM, the fashion school at ASU.
If we're looking at kind of post-pandemic America, where do you think we stand in terms of workplace attire? Like, what at this moment in time is acceptable to wear to work?
I think the answer to that is just incredibly broad because we have so many different interpretations of what is acceptable workwear right now. And even if you go from different companies, they're struggling to figure out what is acceptable workwear because we definitely have some organizations and some individuals that they got back in office, they're ready to go professional, they're ready to, you know, bring back out their blazers and their professional trousers. But then you also have a different cohort, and especially individuals entering the workforce after COVID, who are looking to just show up in whatever they were wearing that day. It might be jeans and a t-shirt. It could be whatever they're interested in from a fashion standpoint. So it really varies.
Yeah, it really varies. But it really feels like, as someone who's been in the professional world for 10 or 15 years, maybe more now, that it's changed. Like, I think, especially here in Arizona, maybe, it's gotten more casual, right?
Very much so. So even if you think about organizations that used to have, you know, their guidelines of dress in the workforce were business professionals. So you're thinking, you know, suits, button-ups, ties for men, that kind of very professional attire. They've dressed it down. It's now business casual. And even our interpretation of what is professional has changed, as we don't expect to need to be at that highest level of, you know, a full suit, matching jacket and trousers, right? We don't see that as often anymore. It's just not necessary.
Yeah, we really don't. Is it the death of the suit? Like, is the suit pretty much done for at this point?
I don't think the suit will ever fully die. It changes, but I don't think it's the death of the suit. One thing we do see, especially if you look at client service organizations, so consulting firms, research agencies, lawyers, like areas like that, they're still going to be wearing a suit when they're having client engagements. Mm-hmm. So it's changed even in a lot of those organizations that if you're going to the office to just do some computer work that day, research, whatever it could be, you don't need to wear your suit and tie. But if you're doing client interfacing, chances are you're still dressing up a bit more than you are in those office days.
Yeah. Even in Arizona when it's 115 out.
There might be a little bit of flexibility in Arizona. You might not put the tie on, might give yourself a little breathing room as you go outside, but it's definitely still dressing it up a bit more than on the day-to-day.
Yeah, because weather, I think, has got to be a part of this, and culture, like, of regions. Arizona's always been a casual place, like, more casual than where I grew up in New Orleans, and I remember my mom wearing, like, you know, heels and nylons to work every single day. Like, that's not necessary and probably has never really been necessary in this part of the country, right?
Oh, very much so. Yeah, it is. And, you know, with any trend, any type of dress, it very much varies depending on where you're at. Mm-hmm. But for us, especially, weather is a huge indicator. You're going to see blouses for women are going to be the big way of showing your professionalism, but you're still going to look to lighter layers. We're huge on chiffon, your breathable, lightweight, right, fabrics. We really see it in colors as well. So, for instance, summer blacks is something we talk about a lot in fashion. Okay, summer
black. Wait, what is a summer black first?
Yeah, it really is just what it sounds like, just wearing a lot of black in the summer. So a full black dress with black shoes, your black purse. So just this, like, really making a statement to stand out in a season when light colors, florals are so popular.
Sure.
You get this trend that's, yeah, the opposite. I'm going to wear all black. Well, in the desert, we're not as big on wearing all black when it's 110 degrees outside.
Yeah, adds a little extra layer of heat.
Yes.
Let's talk about the differences between generations. Now we have Gen Z entering the workforce and having a very different point of view on what they should wear to work, what's acceptable to wear to work. Are they challenging a lot of those traditional standards?
Very much so. So when we think about how different generations dress for work, I like to step back and just think about it kind of from an economic standpoint of what do they own, what do they want to spend money on? For a lot of people, apparel isn't their first choice to spend money on. That might not be me, who I love fashion, but for a lot of people, it's not the first choice. If we look at our older generations, your boomers, your Gen X, your older millennials who have been in the workforce for a long time, COVID hit, okay, we were home for a while, but when we went back to the workforce, most of us still had that work wardrobe. Mm. We still have that professionalism. And also, we have this indoctrined idea of what we should dress like at the office. But then you have this generation, primarily of Gen Z, who they enter the workforce during COVID. So they don't have this pre-existing professional wardrobe, and a lot of them don't want to spend the money to buy it and see that, you know, I have this clothing I like, I know what fits me, I know what I want to wear. Why should I buy a whole second wardrobe to wear to an office building?
So since we're on the topic of the pandemic there, how much did that change things? Like, I think athleisure was already on its way up before the pandemic hit. Is it on its way out now?
You know, I love that you bring that up because that's something we love to talk about in trends. Because as you said, athleisure was already trending and we were already seeing a lot of the trends that just grew exorbitantly during COVID, like the whole wearing a blazer over activewear that became a huge trend during COVID. Well, it started before COVID. We tend to see these cycles in fashion, which, and I think this will make sense to most people, right? You wear, say, leisure clothes for so often, all of a sudden you're just in the mood to dress up a bit. Yeah. You just want to throw on something fancy. And that tends to kind of be how the trend cycle works, as we go from leisure to formal and kind of up and down this cycle.
So are we in a more professional wave of this right now? Like, is that what is coming next?
Yes. Short answer is yes. We're definitely building in more professional. When we look at runways, things like that, we see a lot of classic professional looks. You see the trench coat. You see like early 2000 styles workwear blouses with clean cut bottoms, a lot of like culottes, the knee length wide leg pants and capris. Mm-hmm. Very professional, even from a shorts, for instance, perspective. So definitely entering that professional phase.
So there are professional ways to do shorts, okay?
Yep, there are professional ways to do shorts, believe it or not.
How does all of this affect, you think, the official standard, the code of conduct? Do those exist anymore?
Oh, they do, but it definitely has a big impact on what businesses expect. And companies are still figuring out how to approach it because, of course, they want to maintain, you know, professionalism in the workforce and don't want to be sidetracked by what someone's wearing. And that's one reason for dress codes or, you know, guidelines, codes of conduct. But they also don't want it to be a sore point for their employees, right, where they're having to overemphasize what they wear.
Yeah, you want to make people comfortable.
Yep.
That must become a more contentious topic when you talk about younger people coming into the workplace, right, and really kind of challenging those. There's also a layer to this, I wonder if you've thought about this, of gender and sexuality kind of norms changing. Like, it's no longer going to be all women have to wear heels in the workplace. You're not going to see that rule most places anymore.
Very much so. And that is definitely another factor that really is pushing change in the workforce and what we wear.
Last question I want to ask you, Danielle, is just, I want to ask you if you think it really matters. And I think that this is interesting for someone in fashion, right, who clearly believes that what we wear says something and is important to a certain extent, right? Does it matter what we wear in the workplace? Does it matter in how we're perceived or how we want to be perceived?
It very much does. There is definitely an element of perception. So, you know, it is the old saying of like, dress for the role you want, not the role you have, right? Mm-hmm. We perceive people based on our first impressions. So we might instantly say, oh, that person seems really professional. Or we might say, oh, that person looks like they just rolled out of bed, right? And those give us different expectations for how that person's going to do the job. That in no way is accurate, right? Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean I do my job better if I do it in my pajamas than if I do it in a ball gown. But there is a perception there. What's challenging about how what we wear matters today is that we're trying to find this balance between the professional nature that used to exist, the more casual nature that we've become comfortable with, and what that means for, like you said, codes of conduct, for what is acceptable work apparel and maintains that professional appeal.
Yeah. All right. More questions if I have, but I'll stop now. Danielle Testa, assistant professor at ASU FITM, joining us. Danielle, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great.
Before employees have to decide what to wear to work, they first need to get a job. And to do that, more and more people are relying on their personal brands to help them in the job market, both online and in real-life job interviews. Nancy Gray is a professor in the marketing department at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business, where she teaches all things having to do with brand development. And Nancy, for how long has it been a thing that prospective employees have been trying to build up a personal brand to show off to prospective employers?
Ever since there was a job posting and somebody wanting to fulfill that, really it's timeless that we want to bring our best self forward to an opportunity that we see that would be beneficial to us and that we can bring value to the organization. But in today's world, this has come to the forefront because it's so easy for us to have a presence that is online for the world to see. So this question is one that comes up often, and I've heard it asked, is this a new thing? You know, in 1990s, there was a business consultant, Tom Peters, and he back then said, if people need to focus on crafting a personal brand at that time. So he kind of brought that to the modern forefront of this. And he believed that you really had to create this brand called you and what that looked like.
Are we thinking about it differently, or has how we think about that evolved over time? I just think back to when I was looking for jobs in the 90s, and I don't think anybody said to me, what is your personal brand? It was more, what can you bring to this job?
Yeah, you know, I think it's semantics. I think that what you were bringing to the job and how you were expressing yourself and how you wanted yourself to be viewed by that particular employer, that was your brand. You may not have called it such, but that was who you wanted that person to see you as. What's changed about that today is that it's not just that person that is in the room that you are creating and crafting an answer for. You are able to put who you are out there in ways, and we enjoy putting ourselves out there. So we use social media. We put ourselves out on our Instagram stories, or maybe we have a feed on X. And so we're curating, crafting who we are. And so as we do that, we create extensions of ourselves out into, we put those out into the world. And so instead of it just being confined to a room and someone asking you who you are, the whole world has access to see who you're putting yourself out there as. And so that is what has changed.
Well, it almost sounds like part of the brand is being careful not to show something that an employer will find objectionable, in addition to, or maybe instead of, showing them things that they wanted as part of their company.
Well, I think there's both. I think one thing that somebody, if you're trying to work on building your personal brand and you say, okay, I want to create my presence, I want to show who I am, it's really important to be authentic in who you are and putting that out there and to be consistent in that. And so I think that keep in mind that people are going to be looking at it, but at the same time, if you're putting something up there just because you think somebody wants to see that and they have an experience with you, let's face it, a brand is a promise. So if their experience and what they find out about you is different than what you're putting out there, you've just lost that. You're in that sense of being consistent in the brand.
What is the difference between the way a company builds a brand and the way a person builds a brand?
That's a really good question. And there are definitely some similarities in that if a company is building a brand, the first thing I'm going to ask them is the so what. Why does anybody on the planet need what you're offering, whether it be a service, whether it be a product, whether it be an idea? And what value does this bring? And so I think the same thing applies to building a personal brand is the so what. You know, who am I? What do I bring? What values do I bring? What skills do I bring? And just doing a reflection on what that is.
Do you find that the concept of employees or prospective employees having a personal brand, is that more prevalent or maybe more important in some industries or types of jobs than others?
Oh, absolutely. I think if you are, I teach in a marketing department. And so if you were looking for a job in having to do with marketing, it's a lot about storytelling. So mm-hmm. How you tell your own story is very, very relevant. My education is in design. My PhD is from the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts. So if you are a design student or anybody in the arts, then absolutely your brand, your portfolio, your presence is critically important. I would imagine in other fields it's not as much. However, I think the need to have a good presence on LinkedIn is ubiquitous.
I just wonder if, like, depending on how public-facing or forward-facing your job is, if it makes it more important. Like, I can imagine, for example, an attorney might have a particular brand that they are trying to get across to potential clients, or a radio host, for example, you know, might have a particular brand that they would like to get across to a prospective employer, as opposed to maybe somebody who's a little more behind the scenes, let's say.
Absolutely. I mean, if you are, you know, if you're a lawyer, you want your firm to be perceived in a certain way. You want yourself to be perceived in a certain way. And so you're going to have to curate what that is. You know, what field am I in? What's my expertise? How do I want people to perceive me? And you're going to be crafting your story around that. You just, again, need to make sure that what you're doing is consistent with what somebody's going to receive, or the word of that's going to get around really fast.
As technology continues to change and evolve, what challenges do people have in terms of trying to build their personal brand and try to get it out into the world?
I think there's no hiding anymore. And what I mean by that, it sounds like a negative, strange thing to say, but what I mean by that is that somebody puts your name into a search, there are going to be all kinds of things that come up. So I think a big challenge is, how do you curate that message? And how do you frame your brand in a way that's authentic, but also is shielded from a lot of the noise that's going to come across?
That is Nancy Gray, a professor in the Department of Marketing at ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business. Nancy, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. From Southern California to New York City, LA's dusty Western cumbia band Spaghetti Cumbia has drawn large, energetic crowds, making a name for itself. But the band has never played in Phoenix. That'll change this weekend. The show's Amber Victoria Singer sat down with Spaghetti Cumbia's frontman and co-founder, who says his purpose is to spread love through music.
Marcel Campos is a performer. With a long white beard and wide eyes, Campos commands attention when he's on stage. Cowbell or wiro in hand, Campos jumps, kicks, and rolls around while singing, anything to keep the crowd engaged. You would never guess that he used to be a shy kid.
It was in junior high. One of my friends, I had a band, and they were doing more like Jimi Hendrix and Nirvana covers. And he said, all we need is a singer. Do you want to sing? And I was very shy at the time. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, he goes, I heard you sing. You have a good voice.
After a bit of persuasion, Campos agreed to jam with his friend.
I kind of liked it, and I just kept on going back, you know, and I believe doing music broke me off my shell, because, you know, I needed to talk to people. I needed to communicate with people. I needed to look people in the eye.
Around two decades later, Campos co-founded Spaghetti Cumbia, a band that blends cumbia, rock, punk, and Western music.
We're kind of like, you know, a hype kind of cumbia, you know, kind of like hype music with rock and punkish feelings to it. And, you know, we sometimes drop a little hip hop to it. It's just a lot of fun. We create a lot of energy. It's a room full of just energy, people jumping around, dancing.
Campos says his goal is to keep people dancing throughout the whole set.
I don't want them to take a break. That's my thing. I understand that, you know, you got to take a little beer break or a little water break. Oh, no, I encourage everybody to double fist because, you know, I don't want you to take a break. You're going to enjoy this from the beginning to the end.
Campos and the rest of Spaghetti Cumbia will be playing at Pijama Pijama's record release party this Saturday at Walter Studios. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.